Welcome back to Russian Roulette, the podcast from the Russia and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I'm your host, Olga Oleker, here in the CSIS studio with my co-host, Jeff Mankoff.
Good morning, or good afternoon, or good whatever time of day you're listening to this.
For us, it is 5:30 in the afternoon. So in this episode of Russian Roulette, we sat down with Sam Cherup, senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation, and the author most recently of Rethinking the Regional Order in Post-Soviet Europe and Eurasia, co-authored with Jeremy Shapiro and Alyssa Demu. He is also the author, with Timothy Colton, of Everyone Loses, the Ukraine Crisis and the Ruinous Contest for Post-Soviet Eurasia. So as perhaps would be expected, we talk to Sam about some of the ideas that he and his co-authors put forward in the recent RAND report for how the current European crisis might be ameliorated. And we talk a little bit about where Ukraine is and is not going with or without that sort of resolution. Let's get started. Welcome to Russian Roulette, Sam.
Thanks for having me, Olga.
So I thought we'd start off by chatting about what I think is your most recent RAND report, co-authored with a few other folks, titled Rethinking the Regional Order in Post-Soviet Europe and Eurasia, where you lay out a way to get us out of the horrible, horrible mess that is Russian-Western relations. Do you want to tell us about your solution to all of the problems of the modern world?
Well, we weren't quite that ambitious, no. I don't think.
You're selling yourself short.
the premise of it was that basically the broader relationship broke down as a result of essentially what amounted to geopolitical conflict over the states in between Russia and the West, namely Ukraine, Moldova, Belarus, Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan, and the sort of contestation over the regional order in that part of the world. And we tried to think about alternatives that might be acceptable to all parties, given that the current state is detrimental to the states of the region and clearly is doing damage, arguably set the whole broader Russia-West relationship off the rails.
And?
So what's the takeaway?
So we outline a few steps about how we might get away from the current negative sum dynamic that we are currently observing, and take steps towards basically providing alternative economic integration, regional security, and conflict mitigation mechanisms that might be acceptable to all parties, and also a negotiating mechanism about how we might get there. Starting with a informal sort of 3+1 Russia, EU, US, plus the chairman in office of the OSCE, and broadening it out from there, beginning informally. And then we also sort of go through addressing a number of reasons why people say this won't work, and sort of anticipating some of the usual counterarguments.
So you are proposing a new security order for Europe.
We are proposing a new security order for a part of Europe that has no security order right now.
All right. And what would that look like? What would a collaborative security mechanism or economic order for these countries look like?
So the principles, and we're trying to get more in depth into what the details of it and future stages of the same project. But the principles of it on the economic side would be multi-directional economic integration. In other words, sort of the opposite of what we have today, where on the one hand, the Eurasian Economic Union, on the other hand, the European Union's deep and comprehensive free trade agreement are offering mutually incompatible and thus unidirectional economic integration. On the security side, multilateral security commitments and that produce not only withdrawal from areas that are currently not subject to territorial dispute, but also multilateral assurances about future use of force or lack thereof. Commitments to consult about any potential changes to the regional order in the future, and a number of other similar measures that, you know, one could imagine there being some degree of mutual acceptance of. And the point is that at the moment, these countries are actually don't have attractive options that allow them to not be subject to the kind of insecurity and lack of and the disruption of trade ties and so on that they're currently experiencing, and in some cases, as in Ukraine, you know, a war that has killed over 10,000 people.
So, but to a large extent, what you're proposing is a freezing of the in-between status, right?
The idea is that is to transform what it means to be in between from a liability as it is now to some sort of an asset whereby it's not...
Whereby one prefers to be Ukraine to, say, being France?
Well, I wouldn't quite go that far.
Yeah.
But where,
I didn't think so.
Whereby one prefers to have the kind of arrangements that we're talking about to the status quo, right? I mean, we're not talking about providing... You know, transforming Ukraine into France. We're talking about improving what is a terrible situation into something more stable, more secure, and one that allows for potentially more prosperity.
I mean, let's talk about the objections. I mean, I think Olya was hinting at one of the big objections to something like this is that people in these countries themselves may have other ideas about what their preferences are. How do you deal with that problem?
So we directly tested that proposition by commissioning new original polling data in 5 of the 6 in-between countries, so everyone but Azerbaijan. And we posed questions in a different way than these are usually posed about people's preferences regarding regional security arrangements and economic integration. And specifically, usually the question is asked, like, do you, Moldovan, Ukrainian, prefer the EU or membership or EU membership versus Eurasian Economic Union membership? Or do you prefer NATO versus the Collective Security Treaty Organization? And what we did was provide a third option, which is equally close relations with both, and actually offered the respondents the opportunity to volunteer the response of not have any relations with any union. And what was striking is that in 4 of these 5 countries, there were majorities who supported this sort of third way. Ukraine was the exception there, although there was a significant, you know, we're talking between 30 and 40%, I believe, support in that context too. And one would assume that if the war were to end, that it might be a little bit different. And of course, that doesn't take into account areas where we couldn't poll, which are not under government control at the moment. So we did find that there is a reservoir of support in these places for alternatives that could, that would be different than what is nominally currently on offer. And of course, one needs to underscore that actually the options which we talk about, that is membership in Euro-Atlantic institutions, aren't actually on the table today. So,
right. I mean, I think one of my usual counters to the argument that countries get to choose their own security alliances is the alliances also have to choose the countries.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, the principle of freedom of choice applies to members of existing institutions as much as it does to non-members. In other words, Georgia doesn't get to choose what American foreign policy is regarding Georgian membership in NATO. And just as with any NATO ally, the U.S. can either support that or not. Or just and that does get to a broader point about the principle, which is another objection that one often hears, that this is about that countries do have this right.
It's a matter of sovereignty.
I'm sorry?
It's a matter of sovereignty.
Yes. Well, the argument is usually a little bit more specific that they have the right to choose. Well, that they have the right to be a member of whatever organization they would like to be. And in fact, the language on that, which dates from the Helsinki Final Act, is much more abstract. It's about the right to be a party or not be a party to organizations, generally speaking, and does not say that any country has a particular right to be a member of any particular organization. The point is that, you know, we're not, no country has the right to dictate to existing unions or alliances what states should be members of it. What I think has gotten NATO and the EU in trouble is, particularly NATO, is the commitment to this principle of the open door.
Hmm.
Although interestingly, and we went back to the history here too, the open door was never meant to be this kind of never-ending process, which it has now been construed as. In the very beginning, there were, you know, and including from the U.S. Congress, strong statements about future consideration of candidates being done on a case-by-case basis and whether it's in the interest of the alliance or not. And that was also what was stated in the original document laying out the terms for NATO enlargement. But today we've gotten ourselves wrapped around the axle with this, and it sort of has been read as, you know, we are obliged to provide membership perspectives to those countries that ask for
it. It's the video game model, right? If you attain level one, you get to go on to, without losing too many lives, you go on to level two, and then level three, and then level four, and the final level is NATO membership.
Right.
Yeah. I was going to say, I think I look at it slightly differently, which is that the original perspective on enlargement may have been somewhat limited, and that has evolved over time. But again, NATO as an organization of sovereign countries has the right to make that determination. Now, whether the determination is in its interest or not is a separate question. But, you know, whether or not that was the original intention, I think, you know, we are at a place now where NATO collectively and largely at the instigation of the U.S. has made this determination that this kind of wide open door, or not wide open because not a lot of countries are coming through it, but this principle of the open door is something that is worth defending as a principle.
Right. But the reason I go back to the original way in which the open door was construed, and it was, you were talking about language from a summit statement in 1997, Madrid, I believe, is that that is nominally where the principle comes from. And it's just that the principle is being construed in a way that it wasn't originally intended and suggesting a degree of automaticity about membership processes which doesn't really exist. Now, all this would be different if there were actually a consensus within the alliance on granting a membership perspective to any of the countries mm-hmm. under consideration, which isn't the case. And there's no plausible way in which that would change. The where I think we've gotten into a particular problem is stemming from the Budapest Declaration, Bucharest Declaration of 2008, whereby there was this compromised language that ended up committing NATO to the idea that Ukraine and Georgia, quote unquote, will become members of NATO at some right. unspecified date in the future.
But I think this is where the consensus in NATO is, because you don't have agreement on short-term enlargement, but you also don't have agreement on the principle that, or the idea that there's not going to be future enlargement. So this is kind of a way of threading the needle.
Right, which I think leaves particularly Ukraine with the worst of all worlds, which is that the threat of future enlargement, I think, looms large mm-hmm. in Russian threat perceptions and thus affecting their actions. But Ukraine doesn't get any security guarantees. Right, so the worst of all worlds. I'm realistic about the prospect that you're not going to get a rollback of a over decade old summit statement, commitment made there. But the question is, the argument we make is that rather than think about taking things off the table, is that you put something new on the table, an option for a country like Ukraine or Georgia that is more attractive than this never-ending accession process, which you know, at some point someone's going to call the bluff about, right? I mean, it can't go on forever. I mean, it will go on forever
it's been going on for a while.
But that this sort of third way would offer more concrete benefits both to elites and publics, and that it could thus be more attractive.
So do you, in the sense that you have this proposal out there, do you see the appetite among policymakers for this idea more in the United States, more in Europe, more in Russia? Who do you think you might expect to run with this?
So
in the in-between states themselves?
Being realistic, in the current political climate, it's impossible to imagine this moving very far at the moment. And we sort of think about this as creation of an alternative intellectual framework. At the moment, you know, we have the idea of enlargement of Euro-Atlantic institutions, and then we have, on the other hand, this sort of void. And so having a credible alternative, even if it is just an intellectual framework.
Eurasian Economic Union, what do you mean?
Right. And so that is also not a credible intellectual framework, in the sense that further enlargement of Russia-led institutions to these countries mm-hmm. is not credible either. So I think that's valuable, that is creation of an idea, at least, mm-hmm. that is concrete and has some substance to it, in itself is important. That having been said, it does, you hear this from European officials, and you see this in the speeches of European leaders, that they, particularly Western European leaders, are looking for ideas on this subject in a way that I don't think you hear much in Washington in terms of demand. And
certainly not now.
Yes. And, you know, interestingly, in one of the places where we did a rollout event for the that report was Belarus, where there is a lot of kind of receptivity to.
So here's a question. Could a deal of the sort that you propose, or a set of deals of the sort you propose, be struck without the United States being particularly involved?
Seems to me highly unlikely, in part because of Russian threat perceptions, right? I mean, ultimately, that's what we're what they're concerned about, we the U.S., and in part because given our ability to affect our partners' policies on these issues, if there's something that the U.S. doesn't like, we're probably going to stick a wrench in the you know, spokes or something, if that is in fact the case. So it's hard for me to imagine that under, you know, all things being equal, or the, you know, imagining the current circumstances, relatively speaking, projecting out, I don't know, in a 5-year perspective. However, in the long term, I don't know, right? I mean, if it's just the U.S. that's standing in the way of this, at the moment, you know, the Russians are doing us a favor, and that their actions make any potential divergence between Europe and the U.S. look like peanuts compared to, you know, what they're up to.
Yeah, I mean, there are plenty of fissures in the transatlantic alliance, but I think the shared perception of Russia as a threat and a problem has helped paper over some of those fissures.
I would 100% agree.
Russia does keep bringing people together.
It does. Like us three.
It brings me together with all sorts of people all the time.
I was going to say that this sounds in some ways like what the original vision for the OSCE was, and I wonder if you had some thoughts about what's different in your proposal and maybe what lessons can be learned from the failure of the OSCE to develop into something that's more effective at bridging these gaps.
So there's some truth to that. What I would say is two things. First of all, the OSCE has evolved into a 57, 56, I can't remember exactly now, member organization where every participating state has a veto over everything. And it's become very unwieldy as a result. A lot of bilateral problems are sort of imported into discussions of general matters. And also, and perhaps more importantly, because it's become this organization that is perceived as being quite ineffective, there's zero political buy-in and political capital invested in the OSCE. I mean, probably three people in capitals are aware of the fact that there's something called a structured dialogue ongoing on European security in the OSCE context. Because, you know, I'm sure those three people are the ones reading the cables coming back from Vienna. And at this point, you know, it's an organization that is continuing to suffer as a result of sort of atrophying of political involvement in it. I mean, if we can't imagine today a actual OSCE summit, right? But if you look back now 20 years, that was where.
We should have them.
Yeah. So I think the lesson that we took away from that is that you can't start at the OSCE region-wide level, that you have to begin informally with the key players and gradually increase the circle until at some point in a formal negotiation. Of course, everyone who's affected by it is at the table. But starting with everyone is a guaranteed recipe for the Corfu process, which, as everyone knows, has become the poster child for pointless discussions on the European security order that lead nowhere.
I think that was the goal of the Corfu process, at least in the West.
Right. And that's, you know, the OSCE is where people send initiatives in order to kill them off, right?
And
that tells
you something. And that's useful in its own way.
Right. Yeah, I guess it does play. But it's sad, too, because it is a unique organization, and which has now sort of adopted a different role in the context of the Ukraine crisis and become much more operational, which is, you know, also good, I suppose.
So let's talk about Ukraine. You've also written a book on Ukraine. Do you see the solution being implemented before or after or as a mechanism towards the resolution of the Ukraine crisis?
So I'd say that any settlement of the Ukraine crisis that does not come in the context of a broader understanding on the regional order in the in-between region is likely to be the equivalent of sort of a temporary ceasefire in the broader war, so to speak, metaphorically speaking, over that order.
But if you have the temporary ceasefire, you can then figure things out, right?
That is space. True. So it does create – it could create space, but it could mean that we have the temporary ceasefire followed by an escalation.
If you don't create
– Yes.
If you don't actually take
advantage
of space,
yes.
So it's sort of this way, which one of these is more likely to happen in the short to medium term?
Well, the chicken – which comes
first?
Yeah,
the chicken and the egg.
Yeah. So neither, I guess, is the short answer, and in part because of the chicken and egg problem, right? I mean, we're in a political situation in large part because of Russia's own actions where – the broader discussion on these, you know, regional order issues is almost, you know, impossible politically. On the other hand, it's highly unlikely that Russia's, you know, going to make the kind of concessions that would allow for a really dramatic shift in terms of their approach to the Ukraine settlement process, barring that broader conversation. So, I mean, you know, it's hard to know how you get out of that. I mean, one practical thing that we suggest is that, you know, you can begin we've been treating discussions of these regional order issues as a gift for Russian implementation of the Minsk agreement, concretely. And I think that has not gotten us anywhere. Mm. And generally speaking, it's not a good idea to treat discussions as a gift or diplomacy or engagement as some sort of reward, because that sets you up for eventually having to climb down from that position when you want to engage on that issue.
It makes it hard to talk.
And it also means that when you have problems, your first response is to not actually try and talk and solve them.
Right.
Which seems
because that would be a gift.
Yeah.
Yes.
This is a much bigger pathology in American foreign policy. But
that's true. It goes beyond Russia. And it's also, in this case, not just about U.S. foreign policy, right? It was European allies as well. But I think gradually we're seeing, and even if you look at the concrete numbers of, you know, intergovernmental engagement between Russia and Western European countries, I mean, I'm not sure that the sort of consolidated position on diplomatic isolation or freezing out of Russia is really lasting de facto.
Yeah, well, I think this is an example of maybe the United States bringing people together, or at least uncertainty about the United States.
Bringing
the Europeans and the Russians together.
Yes,
balancing and bandwagoning.
Yeah. Although, you know, changes in European politics are also – and, you know, that does – so one has to ask from our position in the West or in the U.S. is time on our side? Can we hold this line forever? Will we be able to, you know, maintain Ukraine with this conflict ongoing? Are we content with frozen conflicts throughout the region? Are we content to keep sort of fighting a war for influence with Russia and all of these countries? Do we think we'll win that over the long term?
Are we trying to maintain Ukraine?
Yeah. Well, we're certain financially, for sure. And apparently now with significant military assistance.
It's not that significant.
I don't know.
More significant than it used to be.
Not in an operational sense.
Fair enough. But the point being that, you know, if
with
the U.S.
significant symbolism, we're supporting Ukraine with significant symbolism.
It's
stuff that might have made a difference during the hot phase of the conflict.
Not even.
In a limited sense.
Probably not.
So I think without even getting into that, the bigger element of leverage and assistance in that context is on the macro financial level, right? Where if the U.S. were to stop supporting IMF loan disbursements,
but Ukraine's in trouble with that anyway.
They are, but the IMF
they're still
is,
getting the money.
They so far
Summer. For now, yeah.
Well, they haven't gotten any this year, and the question is no. And so they also want to get a new facility arranged. You know, every single IMF program in Ukraine has failed since independence.
Yes.
And the reason that the IMF keeps giving it new programs to Ukraine is that there's political support among its executive board for doing so. And also, you know, the U.S. granted, I think, $3 billion in loan guarantees, which is not trivial. So I mean to say that, yes, I think to a certain extent, Ukraine is relatively still somewhat dependent on Western support for maintaining the status quo. Question is how long that can last.
What do we think happens if Western support deteriorates, absent Russians continue behaving like Russians. Ukrainians continue behaving like Ukrainians. But Ukraine fatigue sets in. Failure of reforms frustrates everybody.
So if you change this variable here,
holding everything else steady, what do we think happens?
So just to address the likelihood of that, I don't see it as very likely precisely because the Russians are going to keep behaving like the Russians. So as long as the Russians do that, then, you know, regardless of how the
Ukrainians create a certain amount of support for Ukraine just by maintaining pressure on Ukraine.
Yes.
The Ukrainians counter it to some extent by failing to implement a reform agenda.
Correct.
So it's
not totally implausible that this over time will, and given all the other problems, particularly the Europeans face and our interesting foreign policy these days, one could imagine that changing. How much would it? So the question is, if the bottom falls out on Western support, what actually changes?
Thought exercise.
So the real question for me that's quite interesting is how does the Ukrainian elite behave at the sort of moment of entropy?
Right. Where do they go?
Well, do they save the country or
historically, we know where they go.
Well, yeah. We've bailed them out.
I was going to say, but what happens to them if they, you know, make the wrong from the perspective of their own population choice?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, if they decide to save themselves and that's perceived as selling the country out. I mean, Ukraine has had a history of...
Yes. There's that too, yes. Although who knows how weary the population will be at that point. I mean, triggers for popular unrest are very...
Ukrainians go
Poroshenko is like half as popular as Yanukovych was when he was overthrown, right? I mean, it seems like the materials, Ukraine is like a combustible situation.
But for different reasons, right?
Right.
People's frustration with Poroshenko is different from people's anger at Yanukovych.
It certainly became so after the Maidan situation started spinning out of control. But just getting back to this question of elite behavior, I mean, one thing that that this is true of the broader post-Soviet region, to a certain extent Russia as well, but like this is true of the Ukrainian elite for sure, which is that like they have, you know, Poroshenko has apparently a villa in Spain and accounts in
Who doesn't?
I'm just saying
he has an
exit strategy.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Like unlike his country.
Yeah.
Right? So if things go
unless Spain extradites him.
Right.
Well.
So
should things evolve in such a way?
But this, I think, allows for a degree of brinksmanship about their own country's fate that they might not otherwise be undertaking if they actually had to own the consequences of it.
Well, I think, it's a hedging strategy. I mean, I think this is what's undermined reform in a lot of these countries is that the people responsible for implementing reform aren't convinced reform will work. Therefore, they hedge against the failure of reform with various exit strategies for themselves.
Yeah, well, and not only that, but reform might undermine their own individual interests.
And more
I mean, I think that's self-perpetuating, right? Because once you start hedging against the failure of reform, you've created all sorts of interests that actually push you in the direction of undermining reform.
But the other point is that people tell them to reform in order to like improve their country's lot and
that
rents
doesn't help them.
Yeah, right. Like if they're still getting their rents and they can always, you know, escape to the villa in Spain, why would you do something that would complicate your life, right? This does connect to this broader in between question because the way that dynamic developed, of course, is that we, you know, on both sides, Russia and the West, were willing to turn a blind eye to their behavior over time in order to subsidize political loyalty. And I think we're, to a certain extent, reaping what we sowed. I mean, you know, creating these external dependencies has led to elites becoming sort of detached from the fate of their own countries.
Yeah, well, or we didn't have the leverage to do a whole lot about it, or we didn't assign it a high enough priority.
But we do this everywhere, right? This isn't unique to this region.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. It's just that this region happens to have Russia and happens to be in
this region happens to be the one we're talking about right now.
Well,
it happens to be the subject of this geopolitical struggle in a way that this sort of thing in, you know, Latin America is not.
But Afghanistan is another example where the elites have pretty much the same strategy.
Right. But there's no alternative patron there, really, to the same extent. And
they're still hedging against reform.
Well, interestingly, that is true now of Ukraine, right? I mean, one would have thought way that the Ukrainian elite escaped pressure to reform before 2014, which was, you know, alternatively going from Russia to the West and saying, if you don't, you know, pay me off, I'll go to that guy. That argument doesn't fly anymore yet. You know,
well,
now the argument basically is that we're too politically important for you, the West, to allow us to fail.
You can't allow us
right,
to collapse.
Right, and that's a dangerous argument to make.
Well,
too
so far it's working.
Yeah,
and you know, frankly, I think that that calculus is so far proven correct. Right.
I don't know that it's proven correct that it's true that they're too important to fail. I think they've
convinced us.
They've convinced enough people that it might be true, and the costs are low enough in supporting them, and there are enough benefits in maintaining the support for those who want a way to counter Russia.
This is the path of least resistance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, these are variations on the same idea.
Yeah. Okay, so we've been talking about the in-betweens and your strategy for the in-betweens. But the in-betweens are part of a broader region. And Russia has been unhappy with the security order for the for Europe as a whole for the last
generation or so.
last 3 decades. Do you think there is, with or without, I mean, I guess two questions. With a strategy like this or some other strategy for the in-betweens or without it, is there a prospect for a broader discussion of European security and what might that involve? Is solving the in-betweens enough to make Russia feel more secure, or are other things necessary?
So even though we contend in the report that, you know, since this was where the problem really went off, or the whole relationship went off the rails, addressing it is part of the necessary equation to getting us back to a more stable place. I mean, so much water has passed under the bridge in the interim, like 6 months since we wrote it, that or originally started writing it, that it's perhaps a tougher sell now. But to answer your question, so the key for me on this score is whether, you know, nobody really on either side was particularly thrilled with the situation before 2014, but it kind of worked, like begrudgingly. I mean, you know, there was a Russia-NATO relationship. It actually did stuff.
Occasionally.
Like from counter-IED work to training, you know, counter-narcotics police for Afghanistan or whatever.
And discussions on personnel system reforms in Russia.
Right. So there was sort of a practical element there. And, you know, Russia, like, was not particularly thrilled with the broader situation, but
neither was the West.
Right, exactly, neither side. And, you know, there were twice annually EU-Russia summits at the presidential level, you know, an extensive sectoral dialogue with Russia and the EU. So there were, you know, things were happening, and it wasn't – I didn't think it was necessarily leading to some sort of new, dramatically different security environment, but it was – so different from what we have today, right? And so one would think that, well, that suggests to me at least that you could, that the in-betweens get us back to a place where we could have more stability. I don't think we can think about going back to actual practical cooperation at this point, or even if there were to be more stability, but that's clearly the first step.
Mm-hmm. What's the second step?
Beyond that, you know, so we have to, I think that part of the answer to the in-between question could offer broader options for the future. So we're not going to revise current membership of current institutions. In fact, one of the elements of our proposal is that all sides commit not to undermine the current membership of current institutions, as they are both alleged to be doing, the Russians in terms of current NATO and EU members and trying to undermine support for them, and the West in terms of trying to, you know, pry away Belarus or something like that, which, you know,
are
sometimes
we
happens.
To do that?
Poland,
occasional efforts. I mean, luckily for everybody, Belarus doesn't actually want to be pried away.
Certainly, we don't recognize the legitimacy of Russia-led regional institutions. And the EU, as a policy, does not recognize the legitimacy of the Eurasian Economic Union, which does suggest that it doesn't really take it seriously, and therefore, you know, questions.
That it takes it very seriously.
Right.
Well, I think it's more the former. But yeah.
Yeah. So, but my point is that those institutions are not, you know, are unlikely to go away in their current membership, and we should get everyone to not try to undermine the current membership. But then offering this third way potentially allows, if it's mutually acceptable to all parties, allows for potential future defections. to not be as destabilizing as they would be now. So you could imagine, I don't know, a government coming to power in Bulgaria, for example. I don't just to take a not to pick on Bulgaria, but that wants to exit current institutions. And if it had a sort of on-the-shelf option that wouldn't alienate the vast majority of its current allies, it might be a little bit smoother. I mean, that seems like
Turkey.
Far-fetched.
Turkey.
Well,
Turkey.
It's hard to imagine a way that Turkey exits that isn't destabilizing.
Well, right, but that's a different issue.
If it had a third way that it could, you know.
Yeah, I think Turkey exiting doesn't mean it transfers its allegiance to the other side. It just sort of exits.
But that's
right. So, presumably, if there are a set of security arrangements that both NATO member states and Russia have said are okay with them, it's less destabilizing under those circumstances. I think those, you know, we're in an era where the voluntary departure from these kinds of institutions, perhaps on both sides, might be, you know, it's already happening in certain cases, Britain, but that's part of it. But on the broader picture—
Is Britain going to be an in-between state?
Well, it's becoming one to a certain extent.
It's becoming, I don't know what it's
becoming. Not in between, right? It's off to the side.
Yeah.
It's off to the side state.
Yes. I mean, and you know, the better definition of in between that I think we came to at the end was that, you know, countries that are neither, you know, organic part of either the West or Russia, but are affected by the conflict between them.
So Sweden, Finland.
So
I would put Sweden and Finland as part of the West, and you know.
So the Georgians are fairly insistent that geography. Not all Georgians, of course. Hashtag, but many Georgians are insistent that geography aside, they are European. You also hear that in Ukraine. So this notion that countries are organically part of a bloc would be contested by people in those countries.
Organically part of a bloc.
Organically Eastern or Western, right?
Yeah. Okay. So, but I just meant to say what the definition of how to define it. Because, for example, is Armenia or Belarus actually really in between? They are members. What makes them different from a Russian perspective? You know, than Latvia or Hungary. I mean, four countries are members of security alliances and economic integration or you know entities.
I think that there's an issue here of culture and of history and of identity. And of course, those are contested things within all of these countries. And that's part of what's at issue here is you have countries that have been in between or populations that have been in between for a lot of their history. And having in some cases only been independent for the last couple of decades are still struggling with this issue of where do they fit in this mosaic.
And it's changing.
And it's changing, right. It's a very dynamic
process. And the cultures are changing.
Sure, but a lot of countries in Europe that are part of security alliances and economic integration entities have historically been in between a lot of different empires.
Right,
and,
right.
Exactly. But by choosing to go with these organizations, they're in effect making a choice about how they see their identity, at least in
to seek these organizations.
Putting aside the broader cultural questions, which I admit are certainly present, if we're just asking from a practical policy perspective, how do we define this term? It's not just that these six countries are physically located between, you know, on the one hand, Russia, and on the other hand, members of Euro-Atlantic institutions. It's also that the conflict between Russia and the West has an impact upon them,
right?
Yeah. And that's sort of what I'm getting at. But to answer your question about European security, you know, like I would like to get us back to the unhappy but functional place of pre-2014. And I think that is probably too much to ask, but it does not require a massive new security architecture that would fundamentally alter.
But you don't want to get us there because the functional unhappy place of 2014 was what gave us 2014.
Pre-2014, no. I would argue that that's not in fact the case. What got us to 2014 was the contest over the lands in between, right? And so, you know.
But that was part of the status quo, right? It was a continuing
it didn't
back and forth.
It didn't define Russia's relationship with either the EU or NATO institutionally. The nature of
to some degree.
No, I mean to say that there was an EU Russia relationship and NATO Russia relationship that operated despite the fact that there were nominal plans for integrating.
No, I understand what you mean, but what you're trying to do is create a kinder, better 2013, a 2013
yes,
that wasn't
that's right.
that isn't
right.
going to get to 2014.
Right, a 2013 that has the added stabilizing element of consensus regarding the regional order in the in-between region, right? Which I think does make the 2013 unhappiness sustainable and stable in a way that it wasn't, as you know.
Then it wouldn't be – it's a different kind of unhappiness. It's sort of a level of unhappiness equivalent to where we were in 2013, but it's a different kind of unhappiness because this element is sort of removed from the equation.
Right. So the potential for unhappiness to turn into like
– violence.
Over
yes. Machine gun fire, right?
Tanks.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, so just grumpiness would be like a massive improvement.
It's settle for just grumpiness right now.
Yeah.
I think we have consensus on our preference for grumpiness over heavy artillery.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So on that cheerful, positive.
Yeah, it's about as good as you can get for positive notes on Russia-related issues.
Russia-European security. Yeah. We'll close there. Sam, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks. Oh, yeah. And Jeff, appreciate it.
Okay, thanks for joining us. That's our show for today. There's a link to Sam's bio in the show notes.
And also to his most recent report and to his book. If you haven't already, please consider subscribing to the podcast on iTunes. And please do leave us a rating and or a review. If you're not an iTunes user, you can check out the podcast and subscribe via Google Play or on SoundCloud. And if you like the podcast, don't just leave us a rating or review. Tell people what a wonderful, exciting, informative, entertaining, and really just generally joy-bringing podcast this is.
And also, when you're telling them that, you can encourage them to send us mailbag questions. And you
not
can
until
send us,
they've listened to
yeah,
us.
Well, and you can send us mailbag questions, too. In fact, we encourage you to send us mailbag questions. Send them to rep@csis.org with the words Russian roulette in the subject line. And we look forward to hearing from you.
Don't forget, if you're a Twitter user, you can follow the program on Twitter. It's at CSIS Russia. And you can follow Jeff and me on Twitter. I'm at Olya Oliker, and Jeff is at Dr. J. Mankoff.
And finally, of course, big thank you to everybody who works so hard to make the podcast happen every 2 weeks. That includes our producer, research associate, and program manager, Cyrus Newland, our intern, Kimberly Schuster, and the whole CSIS External Relations and ILAB team.
Thanks for joining us.
Until next time.